Community Radio WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM. It's 5 p.m. It's 79 degrees and sunny, partly sunny in New York City. Coming up next, Taking Aim with Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen. At 6 o'clock, the WBAI Evening News. Please stay tuned.
Coming to you Tuesday, August 20th, 2002. Western Plains raids southern Iraq. That's the headline of a Reuters report on NewYorkTimes.com on August 17th, 2002. And it reports U.S. and British jet fighters bombed targets in southern Iraq on Saturday, August 17th. In the second raid this week, the Iraqi Air Force Command said, planes struck civilian and public buildings in Dikar province, 250 miles south of Baghdad. The U.S. Central Command, responsible for American military operations in the Gulf region, said that they used, quote, precision-guided weapons today to target a mobile radar unit in southern Iraq at 6:30 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. As I mentioned, it was the second raid on August 14th. That was the prior Wednesday. Four civilians were wounded, and the U.S. claimed that it was once again flying coalition aircraft. Although they claim they don't target civilian populations and that they have tried to avoid civilians, Iraqis have been dying in raid after raid. These raids, the last one on August 17th, was the 27th this year by the U.S. and British warplanes in both northern and southern Iraq. And also, U.S. planes flew directly over Baghdad. Pea Soup of Deception. That is the name of our programs last week and this week. Pea Soup of Deception. It's the terminology of DEPCA. DEPCA is an Israeli intelligence magazine that's on the internet at www.depcha.com. What DEPCA claims and what has now been revealed throughout the Western press is that despite President George W. Bush's claims that he has no timetable for an invasion of Iraq, the invasion has begun. The Boston Globe headlines, strike plans against Iraq move ahead. The Vancouver Sun says, the war is on. Reuters, Western planes raid southern Iraq. Washington Post, coalition aircraft bomb Iraqi targets. And also the Independent in Britain also reports on the ongoing invasion.
Actually, as we were quoting and citing from DEPCA last week, for the past 6 months, special forces have been in play in Turkoman and the Kurdish areas. They've already destroyed a number of airfields of the government of Iraq, and they have essentially seized substantial areas that are surround the oil-producing regions of Iraq around Kirkuk and Mosul with a view towards the fragmentation of Iraq, and they have already made commitments and promises to the Turks about control over Iraqi oil production after the intended destruction of the government of Iraq and the carving up of that country.
There are 5,000 Turkish special forces in northern Iraq surrounding Mosul and Kirkuk and training the Kurdish Kurdish militias to prepare for battle. As well, Americans threw up a ring of bases around Iraq, in Georgia, in Turkey, in Israel, in Egypt, in Jordan, and now trying to build bases in Eritrea, also in Kenya, using their bases in Saudi Arabia for the The attacks on Iraq, and then the bases in Kuwait, Oman, Qatar, and Bahrain. Bahrain is the home of the fifth fleet. Ralph?
CNN conducted an interview with Ariel Sharon on the 19th of August, and Sharon was shown inspecting Israeli F-15s and F-16s supplied by the United States. Sharon emphatic that any delay in an attack upon Iraq will harm the credibility of the United States and Israel and undermine the struggle against the Iraqi regime. Sharon went on to confirm that Israel had already determined the targets in Iraq that would be devastated. And he made explicit the statement that Israel would use massive retaliation if there were any incident in Israel, whether directly from Iraq or by a surrogate. In other words, any stage of the event will provide them with the opportunity to carry out what they've already long prepared. Shimon Peres, the winner of the Nobel Prize for Peace, declared categorically, "This is a war that the free world must win. We must win it. We must fight now. If we fight now, we may be able to have a conventional war. If we wait even a little, it will be a nuclear war," unquote. And they then went on to interview Martin van Creveld, who renewed his analysis of a regional war as inevitable and declared that Israel had chosen its targets and that even without nuclear strikes, which were on immediate preparation status, there would be what he called unimaginable devastation. Pressed by CNN as to what this would mean, van Creveld stated that the total destruction of all dams, flood control facilities, and the water supply would render Iraq destroyed.
And speaking of nuclear weapons and their use by the Zionist state of Israel, the report in Haaretz, available on the Internet of yesterday, August 19th, is, quote, "Israel's F-16s equipped to carry nuclear weapons." And they are discussing the Nuclear Notebook, which is the newsletter published by the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, in their upcoming September-October issues. And they state that Israel's F-16s, which are the backbone of the Israeli Air Force, are now equipped for nuclear strike capability. And they cite Tel Nof as one base equipped to load planes with nuclear weapons, and that the most likely squadrons to carry such weapons into action are the 111, the 115, the 116 at the Nevatim Air Force Base southeast of Beersheba, and squadrons 140 and 253 at the Ramon Base on the Negev Plateau. They also name, and they're very specific in this report, the Nuclear Notebook, which is prepared by Robert Norris, William Arkin. You may remember William Arkin from his writings in the Los Angeles Times that we quote, Hans Christensen and Joshua Handler. So the other squadrons are the Nuclear Strike Forces, 109, 110, 117 at Ramat David, 101, 105, 144 at Hazor. So this is a massive preparation for nuclear strike. The IDF has also, aside from the F-16s, prepared a 25-plane squadron of F-15s. They're called the ROMs, or Thunder, and they were prepared in 1998, and they have a range of 4,450 kilometers and are capable of carrying 4.5 tons of fuel to get them where they're going and 11 tons of munitions. And the F-15 Eagles are earmarked for U.S. nuclear missions.
Maya, the newspaper of record in Israel, Haaretz, reported on June 26th that the two top Israeli space scientists declared that Israel is prepared to fire missiles at targets anywhere on Earth. Professor Moshe Gelman, head of the Asher Institute of Technion Israel, the Institute of Technology, quote, boasted that from the moment the state of Israel has the capability to launch a satellite into orbit at a height of hundreds of kilometers, it has established its capacity to launch missiles and a payload to any location on the face of the earth. We are ready. We are prepared. Dr. Gelman's words were seconded by Avihar Ivan, the Director General of the Israeli Space Agency, which launched the OFEC-5 satellite and told Haaretz's Amnon Barzilai that the OFEC-5 launch had two strategic objectives: providing Israel with an independent spy satellite to monitor military activities in the targeted countries, and the second, to launch a nuclear capability, unquote. Now, this is not an abstract question.
It isn't abstract at all. In fact, Ralph, now that you mentioned it, the nuclear notebook also talks about the missiles and the fact of their being ready within 2 hours to be launched, and it goes into the fact of the Shavet, which launches them. And these are Jericho missiles that Israel developed with France, and they can carry up to 750 kilograms and have a 1 kilometer degree of accuracy. In other words, almost pinpoint accuracy, enough to destroy any dam, any industrial complex, and pinpoint the center of any of the Iraqi cities. As well, Israel's naval forces, according to the nuclear notebook, has 3 Israeli Dolphin-class submarines, the Dolphin, the Takuma, and the Leviathan, and they are all equipped with cruise missile capability. The war is on. The preparations are on. And as far as the U.S., in terms of how many troops they send, the troop deployment is also going full speed ahead. The number of troops in the Middle East has been doubled in the last few weeks. In the region, there are now over 100,000 U.S. and British troops on the ground in the direct region around Iraq. And it is said that within 2 weeks, they can mobilize the entire force. They would take them, as originally they had wanted, 250,000. They expect that would have taken 3 months. So what they've done now is reduce the size, the number of troops that they would use for a potential, what they call potential, but what we see as an actual invasion of Iraq, down to 80,000. And they now have on the ground the 100,000 troops. Within the Gulf states of Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Qatar, Bahrain, and the United Arab Emirates, between the British and the U.S. forces, there are 62,000 troops. Then the Turks, as I mentioned, they have 5,000 already in Iraq, and there are 25,000 American troops in between eastern Turkey and in other areas. Then you have the Royal Marines. There are 1,700 that have gone from Afghanistan and are now been moved to the Iraq southern border in Kuwait. So we also mentioned last week the joint operations that are going on in Jordan, and with 7,000 American troops. So we have as well the British and American special forces that we've been reporting in Iraq that have been carrying out activities, reinforcing air bases. They now have 3 operational air bases. They're expanding other air bases inside Iraq. This is in northern Iraq, remember, the Kurdish areas. They keep squeezing and squeezing and squeezing the territory of what they call the no-fly zone.
Actually, in the Haaretz of yesterday, there is a special report on the equipment of the F-16s to carry the nuclear weapons, and it recalls this an operational plan. And this brings to mind the important special by ABC on April 23rd, headed, "Is Sharon Planning a Full-Scale War?" And in that report by ABC, Maxine McNew posed the question as to whether Ariel Sharon was implementing long-standing plans for a full-scale regional war. And she talks to none other than Martin van Creveld, who delineates the plans and describes them as the vehicle through which the Palestinians will be expelled. According to Martin Van Creveld, who had actually written a paper called The Plan to Drive Palestinians Across the Jordan, the intent of the Israeli government is to seize upon a U.S. military attack on Iraq aimed at overthrowing Saddam Hussein to launch a, quote, mass transfer of more than 2 million Palestinians living in the West Bank and Gaza across the river into Jordan. Should the circumstances arise, Van Creveld wrote in on April 28th, the Sunday Telegraph, Israel will mobilize with lightning speed. The country's three ultra-modern submarines will take up firing positions out at sea. Submarines, by the way, that have on board launchable nuclear weapons. The borders will be closed, I continue to quote. A news blackout will be imposed. All foreign journalists will be rounded up and confined to a hotel. A force of 12 divisions, 11 of them armored, plus territorial units suitable for occupation duties will be deployed. 5 against Egypt, 3 against Syria, 1 opposite Lebanon, leaving 3 to face east as well. The expulsion of the Palestinians will require only a few brigades. They will not drag people out of their houses. They will use heavy artillery to drive them out. The damage in Jenin will look like a pinprick in comparison, unquote. Van Creveld goes on to estimate that should Saddam attempt to resort to any response, Israel's reply will be, quote, awesome and terrible, defying the imagination. A direct reference, says the Sunday Telegraph, to the use of nuclear weapons against Iraq. Van Creveld concluded that the United States was on board for this. The scale of the Israeli nuclear weapons program is so vast and has been qualitatively transformed by Israel's acquisition of 3 German diesel-powered submarines, which, according to a study by the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, are armed with nuclear warheads on cruise missiles. The Carnegie Institute published this report early in June 2002, detailing the Israeli nuclear weapons plan called Deadly Arsenals. Tracking the Weapons of Mass Destruction included a chapter on Israel's nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons program and preparations for their use against Iraq and in the region.
Now, a key factor in this invasion will be air power. We mentioned last week, and I'll say it again, they're anticipating 1,000 to 1,500 air sorties a day. That means bombing raids. 1,000 to 1,500 bombing raids a day. They'll take off from the new bases that Debka has exposed is being built in Afghanistan. And they will take off from the Al Udeid Air Base in Qatar, which now all the newspapers have been exposing the satellite pictures that show that they have extended the runways, that they have reinforced the airbase for the F-16 fighter planes. They will take off from the big aircraft carriers that are ringing the Mediterranean and the Red Sea and throughout the Middle East region. But what does it mean when they do all this bombing? I want to refer to Iraq and Kuwait, A History Suppressed by Ralph Schoenman, that was written at the time of the Gulf War and expanded a year later. In Iraq and Kuwait, A History Suppressed, it has a section called Some Stories Get Past Censors. And it, Ralph reports of the stories released by Mark Feynman, his account in the Los Angeles Times of February 5, 1991, under the heading, quote, Refugees from Iraq Described Hellish Scenes. And this bears out the estimates of the civilian dead in the European press. Quote, the massive Allied bombardment of the Iraqi city of Basra has demolished every communications center, all major oil refineries, most government buildings, civilian neighborhoods, and hundreds of food warehouses, according to eyewitnesses. I continue. The result, a hellish nightmare of fire and smoke so dense that the sun hasn't been visible for days at a time. In the besieged capital of Baghdad, airstrikes continue for the second and third time, smashing key installations, leveling entire city blocks in civilian neighborhoods. The result? Bomb craters the size of football fields and an untold number of casualties. Throughout war-torn Iraq, there is little water to drink, no civilian communications, intermittent power only from portable generators. For drinking, residents are collecting rainwater from ponds and bomb craters and filtering it through shreds of cloth. These are the images of the human and structural damage inflicted by the most massive aerial bombardment of a nation since the U.S. carpet bombing raids on North Vietnam more than two decades ago. These accounts, backed by hours of videotape footage, confirm Iraqi claims that the Allied bombing has taken a heavy toll on civilian neighborhoods in Iraq's major towns and cities. In the videotapes are dozens of images of the casualties, limbs protruding from piles of residential rubble, dolls strewn atop twisted furniture in what clearly were once home, bloodied civilians with shrapnel wounds being rushed into hospital emergency rooms, blanket-covered corpses on sidewalks, crumpled swing sets in battered playgrounds. And typical of the eyewitness accounts of the devastation of Basra is that of Amal Kumar Bansal, an Indian civil engineer. And he quotes, "I have seen so many bombs dropping with my own eyes. Stones and smoke were going up like the blasting of a volcano. They have totally demolished communication centers, all refineries, all important buildings. They are now attacking mainly sheds, big warehouse sheds with food grains. Now Basra is fully under clouds of smoke. Since the last 3 or 4 days, we have not seen sunshine. No sunshine there, only clouds of smoke, and all around refineries are on fire." So what does it mean in terms of the human toll? 5 days later, on February 10th, 1991, Mark Feynman again filed another story under the headline, "Baghdad's Anguish and Anger Grow as Civilian Deaths Mount. So does belief that allies want to destroy Iraq." And he writes of Dr. Rizak Jabr Abu Kassif, who has performed, quote, "major surgery by candlelight. He has amputated legs of children without painkillers or blood transfusions. He has watched others die from infections for want of antibiotics or clean water for rehydration. And in his spare time, the Red Crescent surgeon read by candlelight about how to treat wounds from chemical and nuclear weapons. Such is the life in besieged Baghdad. The whole time I am thinking we were in the 14th century. There are not sufficient x-ray films or blood typing kits to diagnose patients before surgery. There are no telephones, no electricity, no water, even for scrubbing before surgery. And the air raid alarm is continuous all day, all night, every day, and every night. Remember, they're expecting 1,000 to 1,500 air sorties a day, destroying everything in sight, flames, chemical resultant diseases, amputations, shrapnel, all the horrors of war. And not a scene was shown on the TVs at the time of the bombardment of Iraq because of the extreme censorship that they put in place. Ralph?
The specific weaponry that was unleashed upon the population and centers of Iraq was devastating, and the meaning of tonnages which exceeded the 7 years of bombing throughout Europe and Asia in World War II is difficult to grasp. It wasn't just the vast amount of explosives, but their concentration in the space of 4 weeks over a small country's civilian centers. The bombing, moreover, was in essence chemical, experimental, and designed for human flesh. In fact, the central feature of the willed deception of the public by the U.S. military was the attribution to the Iraqis of the precise behavior used by the U.S. command. Not only were chemical weapons not used by Iraq, but during U.S. military briefings, it was admitted by General Thomas Kelly that neither chemical weapons nor systems for delivery existed in Iraq or in the possession of Iraqi troops. The character and the impact of the weaponry deployed by the U.S. military commanders was described by Time magazine on February 25, 1991. Fuel air explosives, the deadliest non-nuclear bombs in the Allied arsenal, disperse a highly volatile mist over a large area. When the cloud is ignited in a second explosion, the resulting blast packs nearly the wallop of a small nuclear device. The bombs suck up oxygen, pulling the lungs and organs literally out of the victims' bodies. Another advantage, Time writes, is that while the force of a conventional explosion decreases rapidly as one moves away from the center of the blast, the concussion of these fuel air devices is evenly distributed, unquote. The blackout of Baghdad, according to Associated Press at the time, from a particular experimental weaponry, began with a gossamer falling from the sky. The result left the city of 4 million people without electricity. Describing the devastation of the power plant in South Baghdad, Zuhair Abdul Hadi, quote, showed reporters handfuls of an unknown shiny gossamer-like material that U.S. planes dumped. The Iraqis didn't know what the material was. This black gossamer volatile mist was used throughout Baghdad, incinerating sectors of the city, destroying its capacity to supply electricity, heat, and water to the inhabitants in the course of total devastation of the civilian neighborhoods. In the north of Baghdad, a bomb caused the gossamer to explode, detonated after the gossamer had been distributed. Another of the chemical weapons used against civilians and the Iraqi infantry was an updated version of napalm, described by Time magazine as producing a hellish inferno, burning up everything, clinging to the skin of victims, searing them into an unrecognizable mass throughout civilian neighborhoods of Baghdad. Under the heading Weapons, Malcolm Brown's account in the New York Times on February 23, 1991, was equally graphic. The napalm formula was simple. The property is lethal. The newly devised substance, named incendiary gel, burns with an even greater intense heat and sticks to anything it touches. It causes terrible casualties. Even when used in the proximity of intended targets, one of its chief values is its ability to deplete totally the air of all oxygen. The wave of napalm and incendiary-fueled fire removes so much oxygen from the air that the victims suffocate. Opponents of his use argue that napalm should be classified as a chemical weapon and bomb, a band. The other chemicals deployed, white phosphorus, for example, were used in abundance in all bombs and in artillery shells. It cannot be extinguished. Water accelerates its properties, which eat flesh and bone. In addition to these chemical weapons, such as the fuel ignition weapons, white phosphorus, and napalm, the U.S. military commanders deployed implosion weapons, high-flaring magnesium bombs, and vacuum bombs over Iraqi cities. These weapons caused the air to rush in and then out with such force that all structures disintegrate. This is the character of a war waged in 1991. It is but a glimpse of what is intended for Iraq in 2002.
It is a war that has been planned for a long time. As Haaretz on the 23rd of March 2001 had reported a meeting of 300 members of the, quote, core of Israel's political and defense establishment at the Herzliya Center. At that time, Major General Uzi Dayan, who was one of the participants, quote, identified what he called appropriate targets for the next stage of the global campaign, Iran, Iraq, and Syria Triangle. What he said were all supporters of terror, which are developing weapons of mass destruction. Yet here we have described the real weapons of mass destruction used against the Iraqi people. And these are the same weapons that Ralph and I saw used by the Israelis against the Lebanese and Palestinian people in 1982 during the Israeli invasion of Lebanon. We were in the hospitals and saw the children dying from the phosphorus wounds, swathed head to toe in bandages and only awaiting the day that they would die. We saw buildings totally collapsed from top to bottom. Two survivors out of an entire apartment building, a huge crater in the ground from an implosion bomb, site after site of this devastation. And yet here they so openly and as if it's just a matter of course talk about the global campaign, the next stage of the global campaign. In fact, a total war is the expression that people such as Richard Perle use. And we're going to go into that in the second part of this program of today, our second pea soup of deception, because you are listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, listener-sponsored radio, the place to go for the precise, the accurate, the expose of what is happening in the world. And on the internet at www.wbai.org. You can reach Ralph and me at Veritas, V-E-R-I-T-A-S 9, that's the number 9, Veritas 9, at PacBell, PacBell.net, that's our email, or you can write to us at Veritas Press, P.O. Box 6345, Vallejo, V-A-L-L-E-J-O, California 94591. And we have available a special two-part audio cassette or CD of Pea Soup of Deception. And as well, you can get Iraq and Kuwait, A History Suppressed. And for those of you who want to read more about the strategy, the long-standing strategy describing the fragmentation of the Middle East that had been written by the Israeli military strategist Odedi Nang, you can get that in The Hidden History of Zionism, also available from us. And I want to take this moment to thank our engineers, Matthew Finch, the Public Affairs Director at WBAI in New York, and here at KPFA in California, in Berkeley, William Walker, as well our associate Bradley Wiedmeyer. Ralph, do you want to go into the total war and the machinations of Richard Perle?
Yes, I do, Meyer, but I want to mention that in particular Van Creveld's declaration yesterday on CNN that Israel was intending to devastate the dams, and one has to keep in mind that the dams that surround the upper part of Baghdad are the only vehicle through which the flooding of the entire city can be prevented. And it is these dams that are being targeted, and it is but the little continuation of what was revealed by Thomas Nagy in The Progressive in an article that was entitled "The Secret Behind the Sanctions, How the U.S. Intentionally Destroyed Iraq's Water Supply." And he writes, "Over the last 2 years, I have discovered documents of the Defense Intelligence Agency proving beyond a shadow of a doubt that the United States government has intentionally deployed the sanctions against Iraq to degrade the country's water supply after the Gulf War. The United States knew the cost that civilian Iraqis, mostly children, would pay. It went ahead anyway. The primary document, Iraq Water Treatment Vulnerabilities, is dated January 22, 1991, and it spells out how sanctions can be deployed to prevent Iraq from supplying clean water to its citizens. And the detailing of this targeting of the water distribution system in Iraq, which are from a Defense Intelligence Agency report, indicate that the purpose of sanctions was the continuation of the war in what is, in essence, a policy of mass destruction. Not just weapons of mass destruction, but a design and a policy of mass destruction. And it is but the implementation of the strategy for conquest delineated by Odedi Nin in 1979 and 1980 as a policy for the fragmentation of each country in the Middle East in turn, the reintroduction of the millet system of the Ottoman Empire when the area was broken up into ethnic components so that the imperial rule would be facilitated. And Oded Yunon made explicit that Iraq was the target that was given top priority. Rich in oil, internally in torn, on the other, guaranteed as a candidate for Israel. Its dissolution is even more important than that of Syria. It is stronger than Syria. In the short run, it is Iraqi power, which we must destroy. And the article then, or rather the study, the Oded Yunon report, strategy for conquest, strategy for Israel in the 1980s, describes how Israel's designs are essentially at the behest of U.S. imperialism, U.S. Military and financial support of Israel, which facilitates this, and they describe the intent to undo the control of Saudi Arabia by the monarchy, however servile it has been, to eliminate OPEC, to fragment Arabia, and after that, Egypt. So each nation in turn. And it's instructive, I should mention, that in the September 2nd, 2002 issue of The Nation, a feature story by Jason Vest called The Men from Jinsa and CSP. And it begins, almost 30 years ago, a prominent group of neoconservative hawks found an effective vehicle for imposing their views via the Committee on the Present Danger, a group that fervently believed that the United States was a hair away from being militarily surpassed by the Soviet Union, whose raison d'etre was a strident advocacy of bigger military budgets, championing a Likud Israel, considered a marginal group. With the election of 1980, it went from the margins to the center of power. Just as the right-wing defense intellectuals made the Committee on the Present Danger a cornerstone of a shadow defense establishment during the Carter administration, so did the right during the Clinton years through two organizations, the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, JINSA, and the Center for Security Policy. On no issue is the JINSA-CSP line more evident than its relentless campaign for war, not just with Iraq, but, quote, total war, unquote, as Michael Ledeen, the most influential JINSA's persona in Washington, put it last year. For this group, regime change by any means necessary must be imposed in Iraq, Iran, Syria, and Saudi Arabia. Anyone who dissents is committing heresy against articles of faith. The Pentagon's Defense Policy Board is chaired by JINSA CSP advisor and former Reagan administration Defense Department official Richard Perle, and stacked with figures from both groups, they now cast Saudi Arabia as an enemy to be brought to heel through a number of mechanisms which mirror JINSA's agenda and reflect their preoccupation with Egypt. And here is a stunning echo of the Oded Yunon report. Grand strategy on the Middle East will concentrate on Iraq as the tactical pivot. This is from the 2002 September 2nd issue of The Nation. Concentrate on Iraq as the tactical pivot, Saudi Arabia as the strategic pivot, and Egypt as the prize.
Now that quote, the grand strategy for the Middle East, was made during a slide presentation, a PowerPoint briefing, that was done by the Defense Policy Board in Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld's private conference room last month. And it is, you can read more about it inside the Secret War Council in time.com in the August 26th issue of Time Magazine, which is available on the internet. Richard Pearl was, as Ralph said, in the Reagan administration's Defense Department, he was an official, and now he chairs this committee, the Defense Policy Board, which is an advisory committee for Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, and in fact, it is a mouthpiece of the war machine.
But Maya, inside the Secret War Council describes how an unpaid, ultra-conservative board holds private meetings and puts nothing in writing, and is in control of the Pentagon.
Well,
if you slip past the soldiers toting the M-16s at the door, the Pentagon's 17 miles of corridors might remind you of a little inner-city apartment building, every other door plastered with alarms. You buzz past mysterious acronyms, welcome aboard J-3-S-M-O-O, and it goes on to detail how in Rumsfeld's private conference room, the Defense Policy Board prepares for their war of conflict and conquest, in which 10 countries have already been targeted.
Now, these committees, like GINSA or the CSP, the Center for Policy for Security Policy, are not marginal organizations. Their members, their advisory boards, are the very center of the ruling class and the military-industrial complex. In fact, our vice president now, the vice president of the United States, Dick Cheney, was on the board of GINSA. And John Bolton, the undersecretary of state for arms control, Douglas Feith, the third highest ranking executive in the Pentagon, and the former director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey, was on GINSA, as well as Gene Kirkpatrick, Eugene Rostow, and Ladin, as Ralph mentioned,
Ladin,
who had been Oliver North's Iran-Contra liaison with the Israelis.
And this group of the Center of the Committee on the Present Danger arises as well from something called the World Anti-Communist League, which had on it such figures as General John Singlaub and a bevy of European fascists, which was considered to be so far and marginal a right-wing group, except that it was at the center of defense intelligence and central intelligence policy making throughout the administrations of Carter and Reagan and Clinton, and now it has moved to center stage through the Rumsfeld, Bush, and Ashcroft alliance.
Now, if you go to look at the full article by Jason Vest, you'll get the complete list of the members of the military-industrial complex involved in GINSA and the CSP. But to name but a few, we have Admiral Leon Edney, Admiral David Jeremiah, Lieutenant General Charles May, who all served Northrop Grumman or its subsidiaries as either consultants or board members. And remember that Northrop builds for the Israeli Navy, and it also builds the F-16s, the E-2C Hawkeye planes, which the Israeli Air Force buys from Northrop Grumman and is also used in the United States. And then we have Lieutenant General Paul Sergeant, retired Admiral Carlisle Truss, who have, as Jason Vesk says, labored in Lockmarts, meaning Martin Marietta Vineyards, and Truss sat on the board of General Dynamics.
By the way, they sold over $2 billion worth of F-16s to Israel since 1999. The flight simulators, the multiple launch rocket systems, the Seahawk heavyweight torpedoes, and the entire technology with which the Zionist state prepares for devastation involving nuclear weapons, not just in Iraq.
And we go on. You have every one of the military-industrial complex on these boards except Boeing. But Boeing is represented on the CSP board. So in one organization or another, you get the heavy hitters of the military-industrial complex, the war machine, who must take the profits from the sales to one country another, must have a permanent and total war to maintain their profits, all at the cost of you and me and the people of the United States and throughout the world.
Well, actually,
and as President Bush has stated while he's on vacation in Crawford, Texas, the priority for Congress when it returns from the congressional so-called vacation, but what they're really doing is gathering the funds and going to meet their constituencies for the upcoming elections in November, what they must do, their first priority is not the economy, is not issues of education and social welfare. The first priority is the resolution of the military budget, because as President Bush makes clear to all the members of Congress, the money to pay for the war machine is the number one priority in the United States today.
One of their vehicles has been, as we reported last week, the American...
Oh, I'm sorry, I should make clear, is the number one priority of the ruling class. It certainly is not the number one priority of you or me.
The American Enterprise Institute is another of these vehicles, and is effectively run by Richard Perle and Gene Kirkpatrick, and in its conference called the New Atlantic Initiative, Winning the War Against Terrorism, Next Steps, at which Richard Perle and the former Prime Minister of Israel, Bibi Netanyahu, who with Perle and Kirkpatrick was one of those who crafted the entire invented category of the war, of the threat of world terrorism. At their conference, they delineated their plans for the ad seriatim destruction of 8, 9, or 10 countries, quoting from Richard Paul. We all know the list of states. My answer is, we will have to take them on one at a time. And my candidate for phase two is Iraq. And he proceeds to describe a plan for permanent war, which will see the implementation effectively of the Odid Yunon plan of fragmenting each Middle Eastern country in its own term. Perle, Kirkpatrick, Netanyahu, the American Enterprise Institute. Perle, who is also described, by the way, as the Prince of Darkness, makes reference to the Rumsfeld Commission in 1996, which prepared for the demolition of, quote, rogue nations that have the capacity for weapons of mass destruction and the means of delivering them. There is no nation in the world that has greater weapons of mass destruction and the means of delivering them than the United States and the third largest military power in the world, its surrogate, the Israeli state.
How are they going to sell this to the American people? And that is the issue at hand. How do they sell the exploitation of the workers of this country, the use of their hard-earned funds, the lack of education, the devastation of the infrastructure of schools, of roads, of the water system? How do they sell it? By creating a campaign that makes it seem that the United States is being attacked by rogue terror nations or rogue terrorist organizations. And to do so, the Pentagon has now created its own communications organization, expanding. They tried before to set up a disinformation section. We think it still exists, although it's probably under another name. But the Wall Street Journal, on August 14th in an article, Pentagon to broaden anti-terror public relations reveals. The Pentagon is preparing an unusual public relations effort intended to broaden the public debate on Iraq to address threats posed by other nations that support terrorism. In other words, the Pentagon is giving out the word that you had better step in line to all the so-called think tanks and to all the media outlets. Quote, the Pentagon yesterday invited, meaning on August 13th, invited a dozen or so political and communications consultants to attend a special briefing that sought to put the threats in a larger context, focusing not just on Iraq, Iran, and North Korea, President Bush's so-called axis of evil, but also other nations of concern, among them Syria, Libya, and Sudan. Now, does this sound familiar to that conference that went on in Israel that we had spoke of before? And does this sound familiar to the American Enterprise conference of Richard Perle and Jean Kirkpatrick and Benjamin Netanyahu? And what the Pentagon official said that the briefing described was, quote, the nexus of terrorism, end quote. That is, terrorist states and weapons of mass destruction. And as the Wall Street Journal says, they go on to report how the Pentagon aims to shape public opinion regarding Iraq and other so-called rogue states and to leave, quote, a chilling impression on the people of the United States. And they're explicit. They want to shape domestic opinion.
Maya, to return for the moment to the nature of the weapons of mass destruction that the United States and Israel plan to deploy, there was a significant report in Ma'ariv in 1998 on the 6th of February in which it described the use and the prepared use of neutron bombs, as a plan to attack strategic sites in Iraq, including the huge dams in the northern part of the country, in order to drown the entire city of Baghdad. Neutron bombs to attack the dams, and that is only the little beginning, because now we learn as well on the 15th of August of this year that microwave weapons developed in New Mexico are to be used in Vietnam. Microwave weapons akin to laser weapons, a burst of electromagnetic energy created and directed. The force burns out all electronics like a lightning strike destroys home appliances, except, of course, that this will be deployed against not only all communications, but all civilian centers that control and determine such things as sewage and hygiene and water distribution and food distribution. These are weapons that are intended to paralyze a country while they are decimated by saturation bombing, involving as well experimental weapons.
And how, at this moment, are they going to shift American opinion, prepare American opinion, not just for the massive bombing of Iraq, but also for the casualties, for the body bags that will of American youths who will return from Iraq, from either the 80,000 or the 250,000 troops that General Tommy Franks is mobilizing for an invasion. On CNN, aside from the interview that Ralph spoke of with Ariel Sharon, on Paula Zahn's on American Morning, they're played over the past few days and throughout the week, quote, terror on tape that shows a crude one room of mud and plaster with nothing in it but a young dog. And Ralph watched part of this, quote, secret library of Al-Qaeda tapes that supposedly were buried in the desert and dug out and given to Nick Robertson of CNN.
Yeah, 251 tapes supposedly buried in the desert for a year, videotapes now, and Nick Robertson, the senior international foreign correspondent for CNN, gets a telephone call in which he's invited to look at 251 videotapes. He claims to have done this in a day and to have selected the 60 most significant. And with this terror on tape, which is going to, is playing on CNN for the entire week, we are told that the tapes were made exclusively for Mohammed Atta, no less. Dr. Frederick Seidel of the U.S. Army Institute of Chemical Defenses opines that nerve gas is involved. What we are shown, by the way, and the videotape on the first day is preceded by the warnings that this is unfit for children to watch and many adults will may be upset. Dramatic, melodramatic tones, and you see a small room with plaster and a mud floor, nothing in it except a small dog in the corner of the room, and then we are told there's a liquid seeping on the floor, and you see what may be a pool of anything, and now we watch a small dog as the dog begins to go into a seizure, whimper, and roll over. As one of the end of tape, not the billion-dollar operations of Fort Detrick, not the sophisticated laboratories of the Center for Disease Control, not the clouds of secrecy with 239 civilian sites subjected to trillions of bacteria and bacilli in the United States, but a one-room mud hut in which a dog is shown keeling over, in which one of the, quote, experts, the series of experts such as Dr. Frederick Seidel of the U.S. Army Institute of Chemical Defenses opines, well, it may be a nerve gas. Then John Gilbert and David Kay of Science Applications International Corporation say, no, it could be a cyanide compound. And Jonathan Tucker of the Monterey Institute of International Studies says, well, it might be powdered cyanide in a crude biochemical weapon. Talk about disinformation, brothers and sisters. We're going to have a week of it on CNN as our people are prepared for the real weapons of mass destruction that will be unleashed by Israel and the United States on Iraq in the little beginning of a war for 8, 9, and 10 countries and the devastation of the entire region of the Middle East.
You've been listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. You can reach us at Veritas9, V-E-R-I-T-A-S, number 9, at pacbell.net or at Veritas Press, P.O. Box 6345, Vallejo, V-A-L-L-E-J-O, California, 94591. We're looking forward to being with you again next week.
Taking Aim with Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen back next Tuesday at 5 p.m. You are tuned to listener-sponsored, commercial-free community radio WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM. If you'd like to support this radio station with your financial contributions, please do so. Send your checks or money orders to the Pacifica Foundation, WBAI Radio, Church Street Station, Post Office Box 11445, New York, New York 10277. Coming up in a couple of minutes, a report of the day's news with the WBAI News team. We'll let you know about what's happening later on tonight and throughout the overnight here on WBAI. Stay tuned.
Orthodox Radio Crusade Anarchy. anarchism for the global city, radical environmentalism for the concrete jungle, esoteric explorations of the secret history of rebel culture, the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. Every Tuesday at midnight after the news, only on listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. Be there.
Let me also pay my respects to the coalition.